if you don't have yourself as your own best friend, start there. If you can't look in that mirror and find one good thing about what you see, I challenge you to look for it.
Welcome to Backseat Driver. I'm your host, Nikki Bennett, and I'm a licensed clinical social worker. I'm here to help you navigate the twists and turns of life using real-world advice from me and my guests. Together, we illustrate how our greatest struggles often wind up being our greatest strengths. Thanks for listening. Shari, I'm so happy to have you on our show today.
Thank you.
You have spoken before in my community, which was awesome, but it's been a long time, and I'm excited for our listeners to get to hear your story and learn from you today. If you could just share your story with our listeners, Dory, that'd be fantastic.
A little bit about me. I turned the big 40 this year.
Woohoo! Happy birthday.
Yeah, it was a little scary. Almost 41 now. But I was the baby of the family. Got three older siblings. And when I was born, it was a bit of a shock. I was 8 years after my next closest sibling. And when I came out, I was missing my left hand, and it scared my mother and my father a tad bit, to say the least. And my mom said she kind of went into shock. She was a little concerned about how she was going to raise someone with one hand and what my quality of life would be. But quickly learned that it was just a hiccup in the road and not that big of a deal. It was like describing my blonde hair or my blue eyes. It wasn't that big of a deal. So I've spent 40 years learning how to navigate life with one hand and learn that really anything's possible. It's just the impossible takes a little bit longer. It's one of my favorite authors, Art Berg, would say.
Wow. And my, can you do everything? For our listeners, tell us what your, is it One-Handed Beauty, your handle on Instagram?
Correct.
Shari, for a period of time when her daughter was young and reasonable enough to let her do her hair, Shari did these incredible hairstyles with one hand. And I'll tell you, I've been trying to do those on my daughter, Lucy, who's four, and I can't do it with two hands. Literally, I can't do it. It's awe-inspiring to me. There was something I remember you saying when I heard you speak before about your dad. Your dad had made a comment to your mom because your mom was a bit distressed. Could you share that with us?
Sure. It actually wasn't to my mother. It was to my grandmother. My mom went into a little bit of shock, and I've talked to many, we call them Lucky Finn moms. So Lucky Finn, like Finding Nemo. Lucky Finn moms who've experienced similar shock or stress when first finding out that their child might be a tad bit different. So that's kind of where my mom was. My dad, on the other hand, his approach was slightly bit different. I'm sure he was a little stressed, but he actually went over to his mother's house and she asked how it went. Tell me about the new baby. And he described my blonde hair and my blue eyes. And then he talked about how beautiful of a baby I was. And then he paused for a moment and said, she's got a broken wing, but don't worry, we'll teach her how to fly. And
gives me goosebumps.
My mom quickly came around, like I said, and learned that it wasn't that big of a deal. And that life would be just as full for me as it was for any of her other children. And her and my dad literally taught me how to fly, pushed me out of the nest sometimes and let me do my thing and see how it worked out.
And from what I understand, I know you play the piano, you play the violin. Tell us how you learned to do those things. And maybe if you have, you know, Shari, I actually have a question that's, I don't know how to ask, because I think we all get uncomfortable with these conversations, which is why I wanted to have you on, because I think it's so, so, so important. I remember when I was teaching school, there was a little girl who had a lucky fin, and the teachers just brought her up to the front of the classroom and said, this is Haley, and she was born with one arm and she can do all the things you can do. And she showed us how she could clap and climb monkey bars. And I think as adults, sometimes we really get uncomfortable. We don't know what to say or how to respond or whether to look or look away. Can you give us just some advice? I mean, how do we navigate these difficult questions? Or
I love that question. It's taken me years to really be able to answer that properly, to be honest with you. Growing up, I grew up in a small town. I was uncomfortable at first, but then people would know me. And so I may still hide my hand, which I did a lot. But I didn't have to be introduced to new people all the time. It was a small community where I dealt with the same people all the time. And to be honest, people forgot I had one hand. But as I grew up and navigated new jobs and new neighborhoods and new friends, I did have to navigate that awkward conversation. And young, like I said, I didn't. In fact, I had a group of teenagers that would come over to my house and I'd sit and play the piano. And it was 3 or 4 months into it that a guy leaned over and started hitting his friend because he noticed that I was playing the piano with one hand versus two, and had a small freak out. And my friend said, "Dude, you've been here for months. We're like, what's going on?" Like, I never noticed. I had no idea. So I didn't approach it, but now, and I still, to an extent, don't approach it. I approach it just like you would approach that you've got blonde hair or, mm-hmm. or kids, or, you know, people ask, I say something, but I don't apologize, I guess is the way to put it. I don't go in and say, "Oh, I'm so sorry, Nikki. So I'm sorry, I only have one hand and I might not be able to do everything and it might be awkward. And if you have any questions," I don't approach it that way because you wouldn't tell me that you've got blonde hair and you're so sorry about it. Right. I just don't approach it that way. I am who I am. I love if you ask questions. I love when people are curious. I don't love stares. That's my biggest pet peeve is people staring, children staring. But I love when people say, "Oh, it took me months to notice because you just do everything. So were you born this way, or what's hard, or what do you need help with? Or if you need help, let me know. But you seem to do it all." That's the type of approach I like. But it's taking me years to really embrace that. But never, ever apologize for who you are.
I love that. That gives me goosebumps. How, as a parent, I think that's the hardest thing for me is I don't know how to talk to my children about differences when we're in public. I try really hard. You know, I remember the first time my oldest son noticed a difference in someone. He noticed a Black woman at the store and he was like, "Mom, oh my gosh, she's Black." And I said, "Yes, isn't she beautiful?" And he said, "But why is she Black?" And I said, "Well, God made her that way. Isn't she beautiful?" And he continued to ask. I think a lot of us as parents, we don't know how to navigate those situations with our kids when they do stare or when they do say something that makes us feel uncomfortable. Can you educate us with that?
Well, that's difficult for me as well. I have noticed because my children have been around me, they don't see those differences as differences. They're just, like I said, another characteristic of a person. And so when I go over the top and I'm like, "Oh, don't stare. You'll notice this, you know, that Mom doesn't like people staring at her." They're like, "Oh, it's not a big deal." They really teach me more than I teach them, but I would say, have them come over, have them ask me questions. I love when people say, "You know, what can you do or what can't you do?" And I'll usually say, "Well, what do you think I can do?" "Well, you can't ride a bike and you can't tie your shoe and you can't, you know, play sports," or whatever it is. They'll name things off and I'll say, I can, or "I do that, but I do it a little bit differently. Do you want to see, do you want to feel my lucky fin? Do you want to feel how hard I can punch if I get mad?" And then it makes them open up and realize it's not a big deal, but it's because I don't make it a big deal. If that makes sense.
I love that. You know, when I grew up, it was, my mom would say to me, "Don't stare," or "Don't say that," or "Don't ask." And I think, gosh, children really are so innocent that they do just want to know what happened, you know? And maybe, so what I hear you saying is, instead of saying, "Shh, don't ask that," say, "Well, ask her."
Right. Ask her, start that. The conversation. Ask me what's hard. Ask me what I can and can't do. Can I do everything? No, but neither can you. You can't do everything. So I can do what I put my mind to, and I might have to figure out a different way to approach it, but I can do many things that an average child would assume that I can't. So whenever I can speak to a youth group, my favorite was a scouting group. Scouts are really difficult. They're noisy, they're disruptive, they're difficult. But I remember going into this loud group of boys and this woman introduced me and said, you know, she's come in to talk about disabilities, which that's not a good word for me. I have plenty of abilities, not disabilities, but that's another story.
What word do you prefer? I've heard differently abled. Like, what do you prefer? I mean, really, you're just a human. Do we have to even label it?
I don't know if there's a word. Differently abled might be good. I don't know. I don't like having a label on it, if that makes sense.
Yeah, totally.
I don't like the classification. I don't classify you because you can't do everything. Well, she's not 100% amazing. She's 99% or, you know, I don't know that I need a label. If you want to talk about my lucky fin, or my cousin calls her Stubby. So that was her nickname. I sometimes call it my little hand, or my left hand, which is not even a hand at all, but I don't want a label. A label just limits me in what I can and can't do, if that makes sense.
I love it. So tell me about this group of scouts, this rowdy group of scouts.
So I go in and I'm introduced because I am supposed to be there to talk about disabilities, and they're not really listening and they don't really care. But then I show them how hard I can punch, and I ask them what differences, what things I can't do. And they, of course, well, you can't ride a bike and you can't tie your shoe, and well, you can't, you know, play basketball. And they start naming all these things off. And I'm like, yeah, I can. And their eyes get super wide. And one comes up and feels my solid bone in my hand. I can punch him if I get mad. And pretty soon it's the coolest thing ever, instead of something scary. So if you, as a differently abled person or whoever, just approach it as another amazing characteristic about yourself. If you don't apologize to people, then they won't feel like they have to, you know, scoot around and make it awkward. It's just like I would ask about your hair or your height or your eyes or your nationality. It's just one other small characteristic that makes a huge impact in my life.
I love it. So share with our listeners. I actually would be surprised if there's anything you cannot do, just having known you for so long.
Oh, I'm sure there's plenty of things that I cannot do. I will say that whenever I put a label on myself of my cannots, I've learned that that's just a label. It's just something that I've decided. And when I decide that's not the case, then I figure out a way. So for example, when I do public speak and I talk about a Band-Aid and how when you put one of those fabric Band-Aids on, it like melts into your skin and becomes a part of who you are. And if you put a label like that on you and then you leave it on, it's really hard to remove it. But if you quickly take it off and start figuring out the ways you could possibly do it, it's amazing. So for example, I work for a soap factory and I make a lot of stuff. But one of the things I decided from day one, 4 years ago, is I would not be able to wrap soap. We have to use Saran Wrap. And Saran Wrap and I are not friends in any way, shape, or form. Like it's hard to use, right? With two hands.
Yeah.
It's hard. So I just decided that was just not something I was going to approach. And I haven't for almost 4 years. But about 6 months ago, I thought, you know what? I probably could do it. I need a little practice. I need to maybe do it a little differently than my other coworkers, but I probably could do it. I can wrap soap. I can totally wrap soap. And I've tried to approach that with everything that I've put a label on myself of saying, this is a cannot. I cannot play the piano because you have to have two hands. I cannot play the violin because you have to have two hands. Oh, you can. You just have to figure out a different way to do it, because there's always another way to get around it.
And so tell our listeners, because I've seen you play the piano and the violin and you're incredible. Tell our listeners how you decided that that was a can do and how you adapted to be able to do that.
I don't really recall with piano. I was in second grade when my mom put me in piano. There are a lot of books written for one hand for piano, and that's not for people that are one-handed. It's if you break your arm. Mom still wants you to go to piano lessons, so you got to figure out a way to practice. What's been difficult for me is the harder or more advanced I get, the harder it is to find music that works with one hand. So I have to rewrite a lot of my own music and simplify it. So that makes it difficult, but it's still totally possible. I don't know if my mom threw me into that or if I was just interested, to be honest with you, but it was hard. It was a lot of hard work. I play a lot of my bass notes in my right hand. Sometimes I cross my hands. Sometimes I eliminate notes. I just rewrite it and make it work for me. Violin, I came home and wanted to be part of the orchestra like my other friends in fifth grade. And my mom said, sorry, you can't do that. You got to have two hands to play the violin. And I looked at her like completely dumbfounded because she'd always told me whatever I wanted to do, she would let me try. And this was the first time she actually told me, no, it wasn't possible. But I just stared at her completely dumbfounded and sad. And she said, I'm sorry, honey, but you have to have two hands. And I said, oh, well, I'm going to do it anyway. And I left. And that's kind of how I approached everything in life. So she was actually able to find a man who made me, I guess you'd call it a prosthetic, the weirdest looking gadget that would hold a bow. I restrung my violin backwards, holding it with my right hand. You always hold your violin with your left, regardless if you're right or left-handed. And then I put this contraption on my hand that would hold my bow and approached it just like any other fifth grader, awkward and noisy and uncomfortable for a long time. A long time. But I got better. And then as time went on and I became a mom and things changed in my life, my prosthetic didn't fit anymore. So I was like, well, that was a fun talent while I had it. And I tucked it away for another day. And then it's probably been about three or four years ago, I decided I was done having it on the back burner and found another person to make me another prosthetic and started playing again. So when I do public speaking, I play, and I'm not perfect, but my approach is I can do it and you can do whatever you put your mind to as well. And I love it.
Absolutely incredible. You've been through some really difficult challenges in your life. I know that being born with a lucky fin has not slowed you down at all. And perhaps even gave you, I don't know, I mean, gifts through your tenacity and your courage and your determination to weather the storms that would lie in your future. Can you share a little bit about that with us?
Well, I definitely think one of the questions I always get asked is, how is having one hand been a trial? I often say when I speak, it's more of a blessing. Mm-hmm. It's all about your perspective and how you think of it. Yeah, it's been a trial many times in my life, but as I've looked over the course of my life, I honestly feel it's pushed me to do things that I wouldn't do if I had been born quote unquote normal. I don't think I would have stuck with piano because piano's hard. I wouldn't have done the violin for more than a few weeks because violin's hard. Anytime that I approach something that's difficult, I've fought to do that for the first time, and I'm not going to quit just because it gets difficult. So it really has become more of a blessing more than a trial in my life, if that makes sense.
Being born with one hand, that's probably the least of, right, of your trials.
Very, very true. I, at the age of 4, lost my older brother, Shane, to suicide. He was 16 at the time, so small age gap between us. And it's been just like it is with most families. Suicide's kind of a hush-hush thing that you don't talk much about. Mm-hmm. And I'm still putting pieces of the puzzle together. There's never a why, so I won't say what the whys are, but kind of learning more about my brother. My memories of him are only of the day that he committed suicide because I was in the home at the time. Mm-hmm. But my other memories of him are all what people have told me about him, which has been very interesting to learn through other people's eyes who your older brother was. Because I didn't have the actual relationship that a typical person would, I often hear about the relationship my sister had, who was just 2 years older than him, and what she dealt with, what my family went through. And it's given me a perspective on life when life gets hard. I've had some dark days myself, probably nothing like my brother, but darker than I have ever experienced. And I understand just how devastating and life-altering suicide is. It doesn't stop the pain. It only takes away the ability for it to get better, if that makes sense.
I sat with a client last week who's just so depressed and tearful and at the end of his rope and has had many suicidal thoughts. And he said, you know, I was listening to, I think it was a podcast or something, or he read somewhere that they said, when you take your life, you're transferring your pain to all the people you love. And he just sobbed and said, I could never do that to my children. And I think that's one of the biggest fallacies is when someone does take their life, they think everyone's going to be so much better off without me here. And that's just such a lie.
Yeah.
Because as you know, you don't have memories of him, but you know, there's still a ripple effect all these years later in your family.
36 years. And it still affects me. It affects me in the fact that I was robbed of having that older brother. I was robbed of having a sister-in-law, of having nieces and nephews, of having that part of my family that was so drastically changed because of that quick decision. I don't know how quick it was, but you know what I mean? That decision that felt like a quick end to the problem, but it doesn't go away after a year or 2 years or 40 years. It's still there. It's still painful. And even though I didn't have that same relationship with him growing up, it's completely altered my life. It's completely given me the outlook that life can get better and that you have to hold on, that so many people care and that things will get better. Sometimes you have to take it hour by hour. Sometimes it's not a day by day thing, but it does get better. And there's so much help out there if you'll reach out and get help, but ending your life doesn't take away the problem. Never has, never will.
Yep. And I think it's such an important topic for us to talk about. You know, I grew up, again, the stigmas, and thank goodness things are changing. But when I grew up, it was don't talk to your kids about that, or you might give them the idea. Right. Versus for me, when my kids pull away, that's the first thing I ask. And they get so mad at me. Do we have to have the suicide talk again? Yes, we do. And I always tell parents or people that I work with, if you think somebody is sad or depressed or going through something difficult, ask the hard question. Say to them, hey, I know sometimes when someone's going through something this hard, they think about ending their life. Have you had those thoughts? And they'll answer you or they won't. And then you say to them, well, what's kept you from following through on that? That's a scary, scary question to ask. The first time I asked that as a therapist, I was like, my heart was just about ready to pound out of my chest, you know? And as they start to talk, it's like, oh, the lights start turning on and they start feeling a sense of hope. Like, oh, well, my family would miss me. Or my son, one of my sons always says, well, I have FOMO. I want to see all the great things that I'm going to do in my life. I want to prove to everyone that I was somebody. And if they're stuck and they can't give me answers, that's when I know there's really a problem. So then I fill in the gaps and say, you know, I've had times where I felt like ending it all. I felt so desperate and so lonely and so hurt. And it didn't seem like there was any hope ahead for years. But I had to remind myself that it's like a pendulum. And as far as it swings into the pain, like Brené Brown says, if you don't numb pain, then you're not numbing joy either. It's going to swing back and you're going to feel that much joy again. And that gives me hope to make it, like you said, not just a day, but an hour, a minute, even a breath. And to remind them that, you know, I know too, suicide has impacted my family. I had an aunt and just for generations, you know, it never ends, the impact of that and the pain of that. And I know that things get better and I know that there's always more learning and growing to do and I don't want to hurt my family. And then I'll say, what are the things you do when you feel this way? So Shari, what have you done when you feel that way? Because I think most of us have. What do you do to soothe yourself when you feel that way? Besides tell yourself, I know it's going to get better.
Wow, that's a hard question right now. I mean, really, I look at, sadly, the pain it's caused my family. Because when I look at my own life, I can have those same thoughts of they'd be better off and it's not going to get better. But when I look at his life and everything that he was capable of, that he missed out on, it makes me realize that things can change. I had a very interesting experience one time when I was speaking. As I was getting ready to speak, I recognized a woman from my hometown and I didn't know her super well because she's older than myself, but I grew up with her younger siblings and they were in our same church group. And so I was trying to think, I knew her last name, her maiden name, but I wasn't positive what her first name was. So I said her maiden name out loud and we made eye contact. She had no idea who I was. And so I said my maiden name to get her to recognize, and she kind of got this like deer in the headlights look. And then I was called to speak and I spoke and it ended. And I thought, well, I should probably go tell her who I am in case she has no idea. I can't just assume she would know me. So as I went over to approach her, she was having a very, you could tell, in-depth conversation with someone. And so I kind of just stood back and waited, and she caught my eye and she said, "Oh, come over. I was just telling her about your brother, Shane." And then I thought, oh, it's the same story of how my brother was amazing at basketball and how all the girls loved him and how good looking he was. And it was the same story I always get told. And so I was kind of waiting to hear that same story. But instead, she actually spoke a very different one. And I share her story with her permission. I don't use her name, but I share her story when I speak, because she began to tell me that the night my brother committed suicide, she was downstairs in her bedroom planning out the last final days of her life and heard the sirens and went to school the next day of what would have been her last day of school and saw the ripple effect that it had had and how many people loved him and how someone who she just idolized and thought was amazing could be in such a dark place. And for her to be able to see all the people that cared about him and how hurt everyone was, she knew she could not do that. She's now a grandmother, a mom, a wife. She still has hard days. She struggles with depression, but she says my brother saved her life. And so to be able to see where my brother is at and where she's at, and to see how just that quick decision could have made all the difference if he could have held on for another hour, another day, another month.
And you know, they say it oftentimes is a really quick decision. Like someone decides and it's a matter of minutes.
Yeah.
That impulsive. So I think we've just got to, I encourage our listeners to, we've got to talk about this. And
we do. It's like, know, cancer.
Yeah. Yeah.
I know that there's a lot of mental health, like you said, don't talk about it. You're going to give your kids the idea. But honestly, it needs to be more of an open book. It needs to not be so hush hush. He died by something just as difficult as any of the other physical things that people deal with. And the more we can open it up and understand and make a dialogue of it, the less scary it is. And I think the more we can save lives.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Thanks, Shari. Tell us a little bit about how, at least what you remember in the years following Shane's death, how your family kind of went on, picked up the pieces. And then I know you've had other real tragedies in your life as well.
I was so young when we lost Shane. I was 4. And like I said, my family, I think, dealt with that pain in a very common but not a very healthy way. There was a lot of, we don't talk about it, at least with me being young. I know my older siblings talked more about it. My brother and sister were only two years apart. So they were very close, and it definitely impacted her. It's impacted how she raises her children and her fears of suicide as well. But it was something that we didn't talk about. And I know that it caused all of my family a lot of pain, especially my father who found him. And it was only, let's see, I was 4, and it was only 5 years later that I actually lost my father as well. So it was a lot in a small amount of time. Just a week before my 10th birthday, my father was out on a fishing trip in Flaming Gorge, and he had decided to go out on a boat by himself for a bit before he met up with some friends and never ended up meeting up with them. And the next day they found his boat and he wasn't in it. So for the next couple of months, they searched for him before they went ahead and closed that case. And we had a funeral or a memorial service, however you'd say it, when you don't actually have the person there, and went about life. And 2.5 years later, they actually found him. They pulled him up from the bottom of the lake. And then I proceeded to have what I would call a second memorial or funeral service for my father. So it was almost like losing a dad twice versus one time. And that was by far the hardest challenge I've ever dealt with.
How did you get through that? I mean, I can only imagine as a 10-year-old little girl, that's the age when I really started fearing death, I think. You know, my OCD kicked in, and I can only imagine having gone through such a tragedy at that age. What was that like, and how did you get through it?
Hard. I mean, it was very, very hard. I didn't understand, I think, how much I was going to miss out on. I thought my dad was super old. He was 44. I mean, ancient, right?
Yes, so ancient.
He was old in my book. I remember people telling me how young he was, and I was like, he's not young. He's an old man, but yeah. I mean, I missed him then, but I've missed him even more as the years have gone on, and I've realized just how much I missed out on not having a father. My faith is really what got me through. My faith and a lot of prayers. I was surrounded. In my teenage room was surrounded by positive thoughts. And I was very careful about the type of friends that I chose that would lift me up. It was a really hard time in my life. Being in a small town, my mom would come to the city to date, as you're very well aware of. And going through the whole single mom dating is super difficult, to say the least. It was a really dark time in my life.
What got you through it, besides your, honestly, like you just, your insane courage and tenacity? I say that about so many of our guests on here, but truly, like, you are just, in my book, such a hero.
Honestly, my faith. My faith is what got me through. My understanding of life and how this is only one small part of it is honestly the only thing that got me through. It just seems so unfair. So many trials that we go through in our life seem so unfair that we're handed, dealt that deck. And really, besides faith, it was being open and honest with people around me of how I was feeling. I know a lot of people are a closed book and don't talk about your trials and don't talk about your struggles. And I'm completely the opposite. Mm-hmm. I feel like that's how we grow. I feel like that's how we heal. I feel like that's how we help others. If you have no idea that I've ever had suicide as a part of my life, I can never help you if you're struggling with it. But if I'm more open and say, hey, this has impacted my life 36 years later, then when you're having a dark day, you can say, you know what? There's someone I can talk to. There's someone I can hold on to. There's someone who's lost a parent. There's someone who's gone through 2.5 years of wondering where their dad's at, who's dealt with the daddy-daughter dates or the dating, the having a single mom date. That was a very, very rough time in my life.
I love that thought. And I too am such a proponent for living out loud. It's so scary when you first start to do it. But like you said, if you can, at a minimum, just think of the people's lives you will touch and bless. I remember when I first started having the courage to speak out of betrayal in my life, where my first husband betrayed me several times. And I finally started getting the courage and just these little moments to speak up. And boy, I had 3 women in 1 year go through the same thing. And guess who they came to? Me, because they knew they could. The flip side of that is that it's such a blessing in your own life when you're able and willing to live out loud and know that, like, people don't love you just in spite of warts and those hard things you've been through. They love you because of them, because we all have a story we can relate to. I mean, I think of your life and I'm just sitting here thinking, gosh, when I was a teenager, my biggest concern was body image stuff. I went through some real, and I've learned since it's related to OCD, is body dysmorphia, of just fixating on these imperfections in my life. And I think so many girls and young women struggle with body image. I have heard you speak about this before. I would love for you to share with our audience sort of what your struggles were like. And again, how you got through that. I keep coming back to that. It's like, how? How do you do this? How do you overcome?
I don't know, but I'm here. So somehow I made it through. I think my body image issues started as a teenager. I didn't have a lot of control over things that were going on in my life. And not that everything was bad by any means. I don't want to say that, but my mom was out dating, and often I was left at home by myself. maybe didn't make the best choices when it came to food and ate a lot of my worries away and dealt with weight problems as a teenager and into my 20s. And really, I mean, to everyone else, I was the class clown. I was happy. I was bubbly. But behind it all, I absolutely hated myself. I avoided mirrors. I felt like my husband settled on poor him, that he, you know, just went ahead and was like, well, I guess I'll take her. And I just really didn't like myself in any way, shape, or form. And I finally decided I was tired of it one day. And I just said, I can't live like this. It's really difficult when the person you're with every single day tells you how horrible you are. You know, it's one thing to be, surround yourself. I talked about surrounding yourself with cheerleaders in your life, but you can't rely on other people's opinions to get you through life. You've got to rely on your own.
Yes, I always tell my clients, you can't receive what you don't believe. So no matter how many people tell you from the outside how wonderful you are, if you don't believe it, it's not going to change anything.
No. And that's both on the good side and the bad side. If you have a concrete foundation of who you are, then that negative comment that someone gives to you is not going to affect you because you know who you are.
That's such a good point.
And that takes years to develop. It wasn't an overnight decision that I was going to do that. It took years and years, and it's still a daily focus of concentrating on what I do love, concentrating on what I can do instead of focusing on what I hate and focusing on what I can't do. It's a day in, day out, but I fake it till I make it sometimes, to be honest with you. And then when I do that and I try and I learn, you know, you hear about talking in the mirror and telling yourself how amazing you are. I hated that as a teenager. But it's so dumb, but it's so true. You know, if you tell yourself in the mirror how horrible you are, eventually you'll believe it. So I don't know why it wouldn't help, you know, be the opposite. If you tell yourself how great you are, tell yourself the things you believe that you want to believe, excuse me, not that you do believe, but that you want to believe. You want to feel talented. You want to feel strong. You want to feel amazing and capable. But if you tell yourself that, eventually it's going to stick, just like the negative words. If you fill your mind and your space with positive thoughts, it gets you through any day. And for me, it's taken years of focusing on what I can do and what I do like and what I'm capable of. And the more that I put that out into the world, the more I fill my time and my space with those type of people and images and words and media, my life is just so much better when the person I deal with every day is saying, hey, you've got this. Might be a bad hair day, but that's all it is a bad hair day. It'll be fine tomorrow.
I couldn't agree more. Are you familiar with Louise Hay's mirror work?
I wasn't until you talked about it just the other day on your podcast listening.
Yeah.
So I need to do it.
I would encourage all of our listeners to check out Mirror Work by Louise Hay. Something else that I've seen you do from afar and that I've tried to do too is challenge yourself in areas where you're afraid or you feel like you can't do something. You're just like, jump all in, like literally and proverbial. Tell us about swimming, Shari.
I've not always been this way. Two biggest fears my whole life, the dentist, which I went to this week, and water. Water's probably self-explanatory as to why it was such a fear. Not only did I deal with my dad, but I also had a bully in elementary school that would shove me under the water at our activity center. And then he'd let me come up just enough to get a little bit of a breath, and then he'd shove me back under. So water's been a fear. I've loved boating at Lake Powell with my family, but I stay in the boat. Like I don't get out of the boat and I don't swim and I didn't do any of those things. And the dentist, I had many negative experiences as a child with the dentist. And so it was a fear of the unknown. It was a fear of the smell and the sound. And like, even thinking about it gives me chills. But a few years ago, when I was speaking about some of the things that I could do, I had a woman come up after and she's like, I did it. I said, okay, what's that? And she said, I've heard you talk about all the things you can do. And I have a pool and I have a boat and I don't know how to swim. She was in her 50s and she said, I just texted my friend and said, I'm ready to learn. Wow. And I congratulated her, but I never told her I don't do any of those things. I didn't want to like ruin it for her. So I said, well, congrats, that's so awesome. But then that following summer, I was with my own children at swim lessons and watching them swim. And it something just clicked. Like, you're not getting any younger. It's time to tackle it. It's time to get it over with. And so I went and signed up for swim lessons. And it was the most terrifying thing I've ever done. And I remember the first day, my gorgeous, amazing coach that was much younger than me, she said, why are you here? And I said, well, to learn how to swim. And she said, no, why are you here? And so I had to explain the why behind why I was there. And the story of the woman and the story of my dad. And she said, you have to know the why, because this is going to be very, very hard. Very hard. But knowing that why is going to be what gets you through it. And I told her my fear. I mean, there were women all around that pool watching their kids, and I'm sure they were all making fun of me in the water. And I told her that. I'm sure they're judging me. They're judging what I look like in a swimming suit. They're judging my age and the fact that I'm in the pool learning how to paddle. And she said, you know what? I bet if you went and talked to them, most of them don't know how to swim. And if they're judging you in any way, they're going, wow, there's no way I could do that. She's amazing.
Yeah.
And that really opened my eyes. The more I've spoke about learning how to swim, the more I found out that it is a big fear. And a lot of people don't know how to swim. And a lot of people would never decide to tackle it in their 30s, ever. But it's been so liberating to get in that water. I'm not an Olympic swimmer, but I can get in the water and swim. And it's where I feel closest to my father.
Wow.
So it's been an amazing, amazing thing to tackle. The dentist may be a little slower, but I don't have to be drugged before going in anymore. I actually get pats from my dentist because I'm pretty amazing and get through it without, you know, any of the underlying fear. Still not my favorite place to be, but I can do it. And I've learned that if you just tackle all of your little challenges like that and figure out, fear is such a crazy thing to deal with. But the more you tackle it head on as to why you fear it, the easier it gets to deal with, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. And I love what your swim coach said to you. That's what I always tell my clients. If you don't know what your why is, when the going gets tough, you're going to quit. You're going to quit. Your why has to be bigger than your desire for comfort. We all want to be comfortable, but guess what? Change is uncomfortable. It's hard. It's really hard. I love that you're a public figure, like a motivational speaker. And later we'll tell our listeners how to get in touch with you. But I know that you can relate to this, what I'm going to say. And that's that when you do this kind of work, this work around putting yourself out there so that you can encourage and inspire others, it's hard. I'm sure, I don't know about you, but every time I speak in public or put something out there, I get this immediate shame storm. That's like, who do you think you are? Do you experience that too?
Did this morning as I'm getting ready and thinking, why am I doing this? Like, I don't have anything to share. And that's when I found that it's usually a really big deal to share, if that makes any sense. When I have times where I'm most needed is when I feel the most discomfort sharing who I am. I think with the pandemic, my hardest thing with the pandemic has been, I've always been super positive. I've always been like, we've got this, we can make it, we've, you know, in a day at a time, we can get through it. And so I share a lot on social media and I share a lot of positive. And that doesn't mean I'm not open and share my trials by any means and my down days, but I try to be someone you follow because I make you feel better about yourself and feel uplifted. And I haven't felt very nice lately. And as my mom says, if you don't have anything nice to say, don't say anything at all. So I find myself kind of closing in and not sharing anything at all because I don't want people to realize that I struggle, which is sad to say because I know when people are open to me and share their struggles, it makes me feel so much better. But that's been my pandemic struggle, has been being okay to share that I'm not okay. Mm-hmm. But sometimes I have to fake it till I make it. Sometimes I have to be uncomfortable and just give it my best effort. Because I've learned the adversary works hardest on me when I have the most to share.
Isn't that the truth? whenever you're on the brink of doing something really important, you hit this resistance, you hit this wall. Shari, I woke up this morning and I thought the same thing. I did this mental check-in with myself. How are you doing physically? Terrible. My back hurts. I've been eating lousy the last week. I haven't been working out regularly and I'm sleeping like garbage. Okay, how about emotionally? Oh gosh, I feel really discouraged. I feel a lot of shame. I feel anxious. I feel depressed. I'm like, okay, how about spiritually? Dead. I can't go to yoga. I can't go to church. I have not been in nature, like not feeling connected there despite my best efforts, truly. And socially, oh my gosh, I woke up this morning. I was like, you know, I remember a time probably a year ago where I felt like people like me, people admire me. Like I've got friends and connections. And now I'm like, I can't think of a single person that I could actually talk with about how I'm really feeling right now, except for my best friend from the time I was 14. And now here I am sharing with our whole audience. We all feel it. Let's start talking about it. Let's start dialoguing so that we know I'm not alone and it's okay to feel this way. I remember, and I've shared this before, but calling my coach and my therapist on campus at the U, crying and saying, why am I doing this graduate program when I'm such a wreck? And they said, you're good at this, not in spite of your challenges, but because of them. And you know, later I went to my favorite professor, Dr. Dave. I talk about him all the time. And I said, Dr. Dave, sometimes it's really hard for me to meet with people and share their pain and feel like when I leave, I'm not practicing what I preach. And he said, you know, we teach what we want to learn. I love that. And that's my favorite thing about my job is I'm constantly learning new things from my clients, just like you did in that audience with that woman.
And don't you think you're a better therapist because you're not perfect, because you have lived through these things? I mean, for me, I would much rather go to someone who's been there, done that, than someone that says, I'm amazing, I'm perfect, and I never have down days, and I don't know what you're talking about. You know, tell me your worries. You just need to cheer up and move on because life is good. I don't want to hear that. I want to hear that you're just as human as I am. And when I'm open and when I tell people, this pandemic sucks, I hate it. I learn everyone else feels the same way. We all struggle with different things, but just opening up and realizing I'm not alone. I have days where I think, you know what, this is great. We've had so many things we've learned because of it, and we're going to get through. And I don't deal with anything that's too difficult. You know, my biggest cheerleader in my life by far is my husband. And my favorite quote that he has taught me, or my favorite saying, is, Char, we don't have bad days. We have less good days. And it's so true. And I have to keep telling myself that on days that feel really dark and never ending and tired of wearing masks and tired of, I'm a social person. I need my hugs from strangers. I need all of the above. When I look at the bigger picture, this really isn't that big of a deal. It's something that we can take the good from. I mean, I'm completely human. I have many, many down days. I just try to have less of them by being my own cheerleader and putting that positive in my life and anywhere I can and any way I can.
Yeah. And I think it's okay to have those bad days where you say, you know what, I'm going to eat bonbons, stay in my pajamas, and I'm just giving up on life today. But after a day or two, it's like, okay, this is not serving me. I loved what you said about, you know, what the work you do and the work I do, how it makes us actually more effective or more impactful that we've struggled. And I think that's one of the hardest things about my field is, by and large, I think most mental health care workers do not do their own work because they feel ashamed in that. It's like, no, I have all the answers. I'm supposed to be healthy. I'm supposed to be in a good place. And it's like, no, actually, you're human. And so when I'm able to sit down with someone like I am right now, just as Nikki Bennett, not Nikki Bennett, LCSW, I'm so much more effective. There's just so many stigmas. And again, Dr. Dave helped me with that a lot by just being so real and open. I went to him one time and I said, Dr. Dave, I'm going through such a hard, difficult challenge in my life right now that I've been having suicidal ideations. Like, that's not supposed to happen. And he looked at me and he said, you know, I don't think there is an effer in this building, only he said it, that hasn't had those thoughts. And that's all he said to me. And it was like the burden of the world was suddenly lifted because I was allowed to be human.
Yep. Yep. And that's, so
thank you for having that kind of courage to show up. I truly, it's just such an honor. Do you have any parting words of wisdom for our listeners today who I know are struggling? I mean, it's just not a, it's not just a maybe. It's not just an if, it's a when, you know, maybe now, maybe not, maybe later, maybe before.
Yeah. 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 I always say, if you're not in a hard time and you didn't have a hard time, you will get a hard time. Like, it's never ending. That's the way we grow. That's the way we learn. I think my number one thought behind sharing my story is you are the creator of your story. And you really are the one that's going to put the labels on or take the labels off, even if someone stuck them on you. And so you have to decide what you want your life to look like. And for me, I don't want to be known as the one-handed girl that can't do anything. I want to take the world by storm. I want people to never forget me. And in order to do that, I have to be uncomfortable and I have to put myself out there. And I have to sometimes struggle multiple times with things. Try things multiple times in different ways, but man, it's amazing what I can do when I put my mind to it. We are all capable of way more than we give ourselves credit for. So if we can challenge ourselves, number one challenge I would give people, if you don't have yourself as your own best friend, start there. Really, my talk is that I share to the world is titled Learning to Love the Woman in the Mirror. If you can't look in that mirror and find one good thing about what you see, I challenge you to look for it. And that might be turning upward to a higher power that you believe in. It might be turning to those around you that you believe in or those you admire. But find something. Start there and slowly build that resume of love. But if you've got your own best friend in your corner, when you hit those hard days, they're so much easier to tackle. So much easier to tackle. Because you can't rely on everyone around you. You've really got to rely on the foundation you've built with yourself.
I love that. Amen. How would our listeners contact you or find out more about the public speaking events and the different services you offer?
Well, you can find me on Instagram, One Handed Beauty, or I'm also on Facebook, True Beauty Within. And when I'm not in a pandemic and feeling a little bit better, I've tried to be good, but I like to share, like I said, I used to share a lot of hairstyles, but I have an almost 11-year-old and a full-time job. So those have become fewer and fewer. She would like to do more. Some people will get there again. But I try to share uplifting thoughts and stories and quotes and things about my life and what I'm dealing with. And I love public speaking. I love to come and share my story of how I navigate through life one-handed. I have to come speak for you.
You're incredible. I just love you to pieces. Thank you so much.
And that's it for another episode of Backseat Driver. If you like what you hear, please subscribe, rate, review, and share with a friend. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions for upcoming shows, you can email me at podcastbackseatdriver@gmail.com or find me on Instagram at backseatdriverpodcast. Thanks for listening today. And remember, wherever you are, whatever you're experiencing, you are not alone. I'm here, breathing with you, helping you navigate the twists and turns of life from the backseat.